Hello, on this week's program, as part of WRTI's A Day at the Opera, we hear from the Opera Company of Philadelphia's Artistic Director, Robert Driver, about National Opera Week. It celebrates the vitality of the art form as a contemporary cultural expression. Susan Lewis looks ahead to today's Philadelphia Brahms Festival, three concerts in one day by young musicians from the Astral Artists roster. And we speak with Joan Kimball and Robert Wimkin, co-founders of Piffero. The Renaissance band performs music of 17th century Portugal in a series of concerts this weekend with the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
National Opera Week, which began yesterday, is a celebration of the strength and diversity of established opera companies, community opera ensembles, and opera training programs across the United States. It's primarily designed to raise awareness and accessibility of the art form, and in Philadelphia there'll be a variety of free and accessible activities for opera lovers and newcomers. Opera Week launched with a mayoral proclamation of the celebration and features a variety of opera-based activities throughout the week. These include fully staged opera performances at the Academy of Vocal Arts and the Curtis Institute of Music, and as a grand finale, an Opera Company of Philadelphia free public recital featuring tenor William Burden and baritone Troy Cook. There'll also be an exhibition of costumes from past Opera Company of Philadelphia productions at the King of Prussia Mall. For the Opera Company of Philadelphia's Artistic Director, Robert Driver, every week is Opera Week. So what does this national celebration mean to him?
Well, I think it's celebrating, bringing together all of the different organizations in the city who are involved in opera in all the different ways. The obvious one is obviously we produce opera, primarily at the Academy, but now also at Perlman. And, of course, with AVA and Curtis and Temple and all of the different organizations that are involved in opera in some way, it's a good way to just kind of bring together the concept of how many different entities in this city are involved in opera.
Tell me what you say to people who have never been to an opera, the target audience for this National Opera Week. If somebody comes and says to you, why should I come to opera? It's not for me. I don't understand it. It's...
Well, exactly. And that's, you have just said the most frequently quoted. I think in the last 40 years I have heard that so many times it's hard to believe. And of course the first response to that is, well, if an opera is well done, it's not a question of you having to come with the knowledge. You come to it as you would go to any entertainment. You don't, when you go to a movie, have to know about the movie before you enjoy it, you know. And of course, part of what they're saying in that is that there's the anticipation that it's in a language that they probably don't understand. But of course, then if they haven't been, they don't realize that we do translate everything. We have the titles that translate everything. And that has made an enormous difference in the opera public. But it's amazing how long it can take for that to penetrate. But there's also that aspect of a barrier of an art form if someone hasn't gone and is an adult. This barrier gets up there, and you have to break through that. So that I think that going to a place like the malls, when you have these beautifully made costumes, for example, just the sheer appreciation of the work and the quality of what those represent is like giving someone a little sample. And we hope that they will, you know, say, well, maybe I better go and see what this is about, you know. And then, of course, you tell them that they, even if they aren't fluent in Italian or German or whatever language is being sung. And of course, our next opera, Tea, it will be in English. So imagine such a thing. It was written in English by Tandon, and it will be a new opera. So that's a great new experience to get people to come to. And then, of course, I start trying to draw them in on the beautiful experience of having a full orchestra in a beautiful opera house and great costumes. And today's opera singers are good singing actors. They look the role. So that's part of today's world of the reality of producing opera. You have to be with it because today's audiences are very demanding. They've seen a lot of sophisticated stuff.
How much do you think you're fighting against the popular culture representations of opera? Because, particularly in movies, mm-hmm. when the characters go to an opera, it is shorthand for saying these people are cultured, they're sophisticated, and they're probably very well off. And it doesn't necessarily have to get you. You never see an opera in a movie where everyone isn't in evening dress, for instance.
Well, yes, but of course, then there were several wonderful examples. You know, it's got something like 15 or 20 years, you know, where was it Pretty Woman or Pretty Lady or
Pretty
something?
Woman, yeah.
Pretty Woman, where, you know, not exactly a high society man with a low society lady go, and she's, of course, the one moved, you know, the average person. And I think that that is, you know, I think we're beyond. I remember when my nieces and nephews were very young, there were some soap advertisements being done to Madame Butterfly music, and I was very offended by that because they could sing me all the soap ads, but they didn't know my opera. And I'm happy to say we're moving on, but if that's how you have to get to know it, so be it.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia's artistic director, Robert Driver. National Opera Week runs through Friday. For more information, follow the links at wrti.org.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Whether the Mozart effect, the idea that exposing infants and even babies in the womb to his music will make them smarter, actually exists is still open to debate. Yet young children have been hearing a particular piece by another great composer for centuries. Though there's no suggestion that early exposure to Brahms' Lullaby has any subliminal effect, a group of young musicians will be expressing their love for his music in a series of concerts this afternoon. Philadelphia's Astral Artists, which nurtures the early careers of young professional musicians, is presenting a Brahms festival focusing on chamber music, with three concerts spread over this afternoon and evening. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Brahms' life and his musical legacy.
Brahms' music can sound like a simple melodic line or a complex and soaring musical cathedral. It can be dark and stormy, or light and joyous, or a bit of everything, sometimes in the same piece. Such as his string quartet in C minor.
The very beginning starts as if it had been going on already.
Julian Rudescu is the artistic director of Astral Artists.
And you're just happening to come in on this marvelous, exciting, and very dark, captivating thing that's going on.
The work is magnetic for the relatively young astral musicians of the Biava Quartet, so named to honor Luis Biava, former conductor in residence of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who taught some of them at Temple University. Mary Person plays viola.
I'm always attracted to the music that is dark and melancholy, and this has a certain kind of brooding quality, a restless quality to it.
The Biavas, as they're known, also include violinists Austin Hartman and Hyunsoo Ko, and cellist Gwen Krosnick.
There's a sort of quality of real depth, and even when the texture is incredibly complex, there's a sense of clarity to the textures and the form.
Brahms has an ability to take the listener on a real emotional journey.
As a musician, also as a person, you really need to be matured and really understand not only the music, but also life.
Today's festival focuses on Brahms' chamber music, says Julian Rudescu, in part to highlight a form that is heard less often than his symphonies and concertos. Its intimacy also lends itself to the theme of the program.
We thought that wouldn't it be nice to incorporate his personal life, put a face on Brahms and what he was going through at any particular given moment.
Brahms' life was filled with ambition and yearning. He was born in 1833 in Hamburg, Germany, to parents without much money. Yet his father, a freelance musician, taught the young Johannes music early. He started piano lessons at age 7 and at 14 gave a recital featuring one of his own compositions. By 19, he was touring. He conducted, he composed, and he performed, both as soloist and accompanist. When he was just 20, Brahms met the popular Hungarian violinist and composer Josef Joachim, who would be a lifelong mentor. It was Joachim who introduced Brahms to Robert Schumann and his wife, Clara.
And there was an instant kinship among all three of them, but Robert soon became deranged and committed to an asylum and ultimately committed suicide. And Brahms' love for Clara continued to grow. we have no idea to what degree was actually taken, but we do know that it affected Brahms throughout his whole life.
Clara Schumann figures prominently in the first of today's concerts, Brahms in Love. It includes romances she composed, along with Brahms' piano quartet in G minor, which she premiered. Brahms' friends offered both personal and professional support, as in the story of his piano quintet in F minor, featured on the second festival concert, called Swan Song and Rebirth.
He wrote it as a string quintet, and after showing it to Clara Schumann and Joachim, they loved the music, but they thought it was not a string quintet. He then reorganized it for two pianos, and they said, well, this isn't it either. Try again. And he did. He finally set it for piano and string quartet, making it a piano quintet. And all of a sudden, it clicked.
This kind of perseverance was typical of Brahms, who, unlike Bach and other earlier composers, didn't need to churn out large quantities of music for an employer. Brahms would destroy work rather than publish something he wasn't happy with. All the while, Brahms was ever mindful of the Baroque and classical masters who went before him. He explored new uses of melody and harmony within the context of traditional structures and form. Some of his peers criticized his classical sensibility as old-fashioned, especially compared with composers like Wagner or Liszt, who were taking music in another direction entirely. Yet Brahms was held in high esteem by no less a progressive than composer Arnold Schoenberg. While Schoenberg is commonly associated with 12-tone music, his Quartet in D Major, composed in 1897, the year Brahms died, is so harmonic, so Brahmsian, that Julian Rodescu added it to the last concert of today's festival, along with the Brahms string sextet and his string quartet in C minor.
This Brahms C minor quartet, it's what inspired me to want to become a musician.
This has been a dream piece for all of us.
Using both tradition and innovation, Brahms created music that is intellectual and emotional, dynamic and delicate, often infused with a barely contained passion, an expression of a life then that still has the power to touch young lives today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The three concerts of the Philadelphia Brahms Festival are today at 1, 4, and 8 at the Church of the Holy Trinity on Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square. This weekend, in a concert featuring singers from the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia, the Renaissance band Pífaro is performing music from 17th century Portugal. The program is called A Portuguese Advent Vespers, and features late Renaissance and early Baroque music that's rarely heard. Most music from Portugal from this period was lost in a library fire in Lisbon following an earthquake in 1755. Earlier this week, I met with Pífaro's co-founders Joan Kimball and Robert Wimkin. I first asked Robert Wimkin to put in context just how much music had been lost.
I think it's safe to say that musicology, current musicology, would be radically different today if that library had survived, and Portuguese music would have the same cachet that Spanish and European continental music does now in Renaissance and early Baroque periods.
What are the qualities of the music that it needs to be in a peripheral performance or recording?
It's a lot of things. It's appropriateness, for one thing. The Portuguese music in particular is of this period, of this middle 17th century period, is essentially late Renaissance music, and the instruments being used were the instruments that we play. So that's paramount. There needs to be appropriateness for our instruments to the music itself. But then the construction and the imagination involved in the work itself has got to be of high caliber, and a piece that is simply going to enchant, that's going to entertain as well. And sometimes it's a guess. You know, we look at a piece and it looks very interesting, but we can be really surprised. We're doing a large triple choir psalm by a Portuguese composer, João Rebelo. And looks great on the page. The singers have started rehearsing it, and it turns out that it's a magnificent work. Difficult work, but magnificent work. So the gamble, I think, is going to pay off on that particular piece.
And you'll find out in the hall, presumably,
and
in the concert.
We'll find it out when we play it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of regional variation in these Renaissance instruments. In a situation where you're, say, playing music from Portugal, how accurate are your instruments representing that? Or were there such variations, say, were there Portuguese flutes, Portuguese recorders, Portuguese bagpipes, and does what you're playing it on then easily replicate that?
Well, there are not too many surviving wind instruments. I mean, that's one of our issues in terms of trying to get the best instruments that we can to play, because, of course, the process of playing a wind instrument is the process of destroying it. As you get it wet, it dries out, the wood then deteriorates over time and cracks. So that we do have examples from various countries in Europe of existing instruments, and the instruments that we have are fairly good copies, are very good copies of these instruments, and we've worked closely with instrument builders to bring them to their highest playing capability that we can to serve our needs. I think in general with the double reeds and the brass, there wasn't a tremendous variety of regional variation, perhaps some. The bagpipes are another story. You do find different bagpipes that are from different cultures in Europe back then in the Renaissance and certainly in the times up till now as well.
There's also that push and pull between wanting to be authentic and also refining, because if you were to take it to its natural conclusion, if you were to refine all of these instruments, they would end up being modern orchestral instruments. When do you get to say stop?
Well, there's a certain truth to that. On the other hand, we also function with the axiom that these instruments are perfect for the music of their own day. And consequently, there is no need for improvement. They do what they need to do, and they do it in a way that is appropriate and is accessible. So it's hard to know what the Portuguese Shawm in 1650 was like. We don't have a surviving Portuguese Shawm. We have predecessor of the modern oboe, predecessor of the modern bassoon, the dulcian, or in Spain and Portugal, the bajon or the bajayo, was a little bit more representative. In fact, we have some Spanish-based double reed instruments. The curious feature about some of them that survive is that there's a position in the top portion of the bore that is lined with lead, and that's the portion of the bore that gets the wettest all the time in the playing process. So we suspect that the mortality rate among bassoon players in Spain and Portugal was rather high.
And how's it working out for you?
I've avoided the lead issue. But we do know some regional variations. However, we are also at the mercy of instrument makers who reproduce surviving originals. Right now, there is an interesting push among some instrument makers to reproduce some of the surviving Spanish original bassoons that have not received the light of day. And I think that's going to be fascinating because I think they have a slightly different sound from, say, a German dulcian of the same period.
Final question, Joan. When you came to approach the music that's in these concerts, what gave you the biggest surprise? Was there an aha moment as you reviewed the music that you'd selected?
I think when we first came upon this Portuguese repertoire, it was, well, yes, it has similarities to 16th century polyphony. It has similarities to Spanish music, but it seems to have a flavor all of its own. And there's one particular piece that you'll hear in the program, A Salve Regina by Melgache, it just blows you away. It's such an absolutely beautiful piece. It will be sung a cappella by the singers. Things like that, you find gems everywhere, but I think that this particular one really was quite stunning and did take us, whether it was an aha moment, I don't know, but it did take us wonderfully by surprise, the beauty of it.
Piffero co-founders Joan Kimball and Robert Wimkin. The remaining performances of their latest program, A Portuguese Advent Vespers, are this evening at 8 at St. Mark's Church on Locust Street in Philadelphia, and tomorrow afternoon at 4 at St. Andrew and Matthew Church in Wilmington, Delaware. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.